Welcome to Beauty at Work. We are in between seasons at the moment, so in the meantime, you can check out this clip from one of our episodes. Awe is a universal human emotion. We often think of it as ineffable and indescribable. But can it be studied scientifically? Berkeley psychologist and author Dr. Dacher Keltner does precisely this. In this clip, he discusses his research on the nature of awe and how it varies or doesn't across cultures, and how it's related to both beauty and science. Check it out.
Yeah, there are a lot of, related states that we have to make sense of. So awe is the feeling of encountering vast mysteries that you can't make sense of with your current understanding of the world. Wonder is more of a mental state or an epistemological state that follows awe. You have an experience of awe. I'm astounded by an earthquake or somebody's kindness. And that kicks into gear a lot of cognitive activity, wonder, like, how could that happen? How do I explain that? How do I make sense of it? How do I update my knowledge structures? Beauty has long been a relative of awe, just like horror. And Edmund Burke and Immanuel Kant, many people in the past 300-400 years and earlier have been trying to differentiate the awe we feel in nature or listening to music versus beauty. And Burke really got it right, that beauty is more, it's softer, it isn't so in relation to vast things like awe. It's a little bit more affectionate, right? So music that's beautiful just has a different feel to it. It's not so dramatic like, Beethoven or U2 or the Sex Pistols or what have you. So it's just softer. And then we have to differentiate awe from fear and horror, which are really about peril and death and destruction. And awe is really just about what is vast and mysterious and how I make sense of it. And I'll say, Brandon, it's hard scientifically to separate awe from beauty, and your question is very on point. And I'd really recommend your listeners look at the work that I've been lucky enough to do with Alan Cowen, C-O-W-E-N, really new kinds of what we call data-driven approaches, gathering faces and voices and experiences in response to all kinds of stimuli. And you can really pull apart awe from beauty and fear and horror and terror, which is encouraging.
Fantastic. What has surprised you the most about what you've learned through your research in awe?
Yeah, a couple things, that really caught us off guard. One, we surveyed people around the world. The most common source of awe is not religion or spirituality or even nature for the most part. It's the moral beauty of other people. And just that just kept surprising us, we stereotype awe in the West as a nature emotion. In a lot of cultures, it feels religious. But really, in our everyday experience, it's other people's kindness, and their courage and their ability to overcome obstacles. The other one that really surprised us is we did these diary studies, in China and Barcelona and Japan and other places, At the end of every day, we'd ask them, did you have an experience of awe, something vast and mysterious? And 2 to 3 times a week, people reported an experience of awe. And I was like, what? I thought you have to hop on a plane and go to some remote place to feel awe.
That's right. Climb a mountain or two.
Yeah. And it's what we call everyday awe, that it's around us.
Yeah. No, that's really fascinating. Do you find that there are cultural differences at all in the kinds of experiences that characterize awe or anything at all that you find that varies or how universal is this?
It's, I think that a lot of our data suggests 60% universality. There's a core structure to this experience in terms of how we vocalize and its meaning and what feels vast. But there are really robust cultural differences, Some cultures are more nature-focused, like the United States. Other cultures are more social-focused, like China, where they feel awe towards great teachers, right? Awe really varies in the sense of agency, where in the West, Western European cultures or Western European subcultures within the West, they feel a greater sense of agency within awe, as opposed to more East Asian cultures where it feels more circumstantial or forces beyond human agency. We have funny findings showing in the West, in, you know, Western European parts of the United States, awe is more self-generated. So there, people are awestruck by, like, man, I did so well on that test.
Right. I am awesome.
And, you know, that was kind of embarrassing. Like, come on, you know, there's more to awe than you. But that was surprising. So, yeah, there it's just the old story of, like, there's so much that's core to it that's just human, and there's profound variations. And then finally, you know, we're starting to find that awe, for some cultures, it's much more threatening. You know, awe is positive around the world, but for hierarchical cultures, religious cultures, there's this sense of threat, judgment, peril that's more prominent.
Wow, that's really fascinating. What do you think, what would you say are the causes of this awe? What triggers this in your research? What do you find there? What's driving it?
Yeah, that's such an important question, you know, because you get this definition like, well, what's vast and mysterious, or you need it, you know, to modify your knowledge structures. That doesn't really appeal to people in some sense, because they're like, yeah, but where do I find it? You know, how what causes this? And we actually did a lot of work that we're starting to, you know, get out into the published realm. We surveyed people in the spirit of William James, like just gather stories of the mystical and awe in this case. We surveyed people in 26 countries and we said, tell us what made you feel awe. We had speakers of 20 languages translate those stories from 26 different countries, and we discover what I call the eight wonders of life in this book, Awe, which is what brings us awe, what causes it? Moral beauty of other people, collective movement, you know, rituals, dance, festivals, nature, music, very common, visual design, a building's design, a painting, spirituality, and then two that are less common but interesting, which is big ideas. Like, it's interesting, Brandon, you know, have you been moved by a big idea where you're like, God, I can't believe this idea? And then life and death. People feel awe around the world to the emergence of life and then when it goes.
Right. Why is it important for us to feel awe? Can we live like perfectly happy lives without experiencing awe, or at least without sort of taking it seriously? I mean, is it important for us to have such experiences?
You know, I mean, you're catching me at a moment where I would say we have to experience awe. A lot of our data suggests it's one of the most universal emotions, like the vocalization of awe. Whoa, that's really universal. You know, of course, logically, you could have a perfect life and be very happy without awe. You know, and you can imagine that. But wow, you know, when I've taught happiness for 25 years, I often get the question, like, what can I do to find happiness? It gets really poignant, Brandon, you know, when you're my age and like a parent comes to you and they say, you know, my teenage son is really suffering. What can I do? And I have to say, like, looking at the science of awe, that there's almost nothing better for us than finding a little dose of awe. It is good for your immune system. It elevates vagal tone, activation of the vagus nerve. It deactivates the default mode network, that kind of ego regions of the brain. Makes you feel less stressed at daily hassles. You feel more connected to people. You reason better. You know, I know you're really engaged in the study of scientific reasoning, and reasoning more generally, and awe helps you see things clearly and understand big pictures. So, you know, when I look at these data and I hear that question from somebody saying, like, what do I give to my child? I always say, like, go find some awe with them. Start there.
Yeah. Have you encountered people talking about experiencing awe in relation to food? Has that ever come up? Because you talk about, you know, in your book, you talk about sort of art and music and so on,
yeah,
and nature for sure. But does food ever come up as a source of...
It's funny, you know, and that's a really deep question, because when we surveyed people, what gives them awe? And there are limitations to that survey. It's just one story from each person, et cetera. You know, I came up with these eight wonders, and it always aggravates people. And those eight categories that I referred to capture about 90, 95% of the responses. You know, it doesn't have things like money, iPhones, material purchases, sex, and food. And I live in Berkeley, super food culture. Michael yeah. Ballin's a good friend. And uh-huh. people are always offended. They're like, come on, you narrow scientists, like food, right. you know, and they're right. You know, they're right. I mean, we did have some stories of I had the best chocolate in the world, or, you know, I went backpacking and after backpacking, I got to go have a burrito. Ah, you know, and clearly, you know, maybe our results speak to the fact that we've lost touch with the awe of food, which is interesting to think about. And then clearly, I think had we done different kinds of research, we would have found that there are moments of food sharing and food rituals and certain foods that bring us awe. But it wasn't a real common one, so I don't talk about it. And I apologize to those of you out there who love food. So,
I was really curious about it. So some of the work I've been doing more recently is talking to people about encounters with beauty in their childhood.
Yeah.
And invariably, there's stories of sort of, you know, some experience of tasting something someone's grandmother made or whatever that was just this powerful, transcendent experience. And so I was really curious about that.
Well, I think that's what, you know, Edmund Burke was getting at, this idea that there are these sensory pleasures of beauty, a beautiful face, a rolling hills landscape, certain kinds of flowers, and certain tastes and senses. Burke didn't think you could feel awe through smell. And I don't think that's true. And then he separated awe, which is really vast and powerful. And I think there's some truth to that, that food may be about sensory pleasure and beauty as opposed to awe.
Yeah. I've been thinking of, you know, I grew up Hindu and, you know, I'd go to temples. And so there's such sensory experiences that you have, you know, the sort of incense that's really strong and sort of really sort of ethereal. And then you always get this prasad, which is a sort of usually very sweet, intensely sweet, offering that's given to the gods. And then it's sort of a, you know, Indian sweets are just very, very sweet. So for me, my early memories of encountering awe in relation to something spiritual and to the sublime even are tied to that sort of experience of smell and food and sort of very.
No. And, you know, remember, you know, the modern world has lost touch with that. And the idea that food would be embedded with a spiritual culture, like in Hinduism. Or I was just in Bhutan, and, you know, the incenses they burn around the temples, the juniper, that scent is so intertwined with the sublime, like you said, you know, Brandon. I've lost touch of that. Probably a lot of our participants had, and maybe we can regain it.
Well, let's talk about science and scientists. How might experiencing awe facilitate scientific inquiry? You've done some work on awe as a scientific emotion.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, and the best example, you know, I mean, you start talking like you are seriously to scientists, and you and I are scientists, and it's like awe is part of that story. You know, Darwin and Frank Soloway got me to this, who's a Darwin scholar. You know, he really grasped his theory of evolution through awe. And there's, at the end of Origin of Species, there's this passage where he awakens from a dream by a river, and he sees this tangled bank of life. And there are all the forms of natural selection there, of growth and decay and death and natural selection. And he's like, oh my God, you know, this is the theory that accounts for life and evolving life. And how awe helps with science is it opens our minds. And that's been found. It makes us curious about things. It humbles us. We've got data on that. You know, Jennifer Steller, like, awe makes us humble. Like, man, I don't understand everything. And then, and more specifically to science, you know, Sarah Gottlieb and Tanya Lombroso and I, like, it makes us curious about science. It makes us curious about more complicated forms of causality, you know. It makes us curious about the change and evolution. And I, at the end of the book, Awe, I try to pull it all together and say, you know, what awe does is it awakens us to this systems view of the world, that everything is composed of systems, of interrelated processes that are working together. Sociological systems in society, economic systems, systems of sounds that make music, and systems of life and causal processes of biological forms. And I think that's true, that that's the core to awe, is it gives us that. It says, don't think so narrow and analytically, think holistically in terms of these big systems that are theories about life.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that is the key aesthetic experience that most scientists we've studied talk about, which is the grasping, the ability to grasp the hidden order or the inner logic of systems. So what is behind appearances and sort of, you know, yeah, that's really at the heart of, we're arguing that science is an aesthetic experience for that reason. It's
I agree.
In your own research, have there been any moments of awe that you've experienced?
Oh man, you know, I am, and I love your idea that science is an aesthetic experience. And I would encourage our readers, if they haven't, to read The Invention of Nature of Andrea Wolf. It's a spectacular book about this scientific period of Romanticism of von Humboldt and others who learned as much about nature drawing it as deriving analytical statements about it. So, I've been lucky, you know, such great students, collaborators to, you know, and, you know, just to restrict it to awe that, you know, that looking up into trees makes us more likely to help a stranger just made me feel like, wow, that's so awesome that, you know, you look at the drawings of people, they draw their social networks when they're feeling awe, and it just shows all this interconnectivity. What a neat measure of interconnectivity that Yang Bai came up with. I'm awestruck by goosebumps and, you know, the different varieties of goosebumps and the chills and how now young people use ASMR to experience the chills, you know, and to cultivate that feeling. I'm awestruck by the vagus nerve, you know, the largest bundle of nerves in the mammalian nervous system that really looks like it is in part been shaped by evolution to engage with other people. You know, that's amazing to me that, you know, you can find that in the body. So I don't know, you know, I feel when you study awe, it's both a responsibility and then a privilege to like figure out the science that does it justice, that is like, this is amazing, you know. I'm awestruck that a day on a river for veterans can reduce PTSD 30% in our research, you know. So yeah, it's just been one awe-inspiring, you know, adventure after another in the lab.
Wow, that's great. Do you think that that actually the practice of science or scientific research can deepen or facilitate our sense of awe that in general that scientists, you know, not necessarily psychologists who study awe, but other scientists, the kind of knowledge or expertise one gains in their work can actually then open them to encountering awe in ways that others may not have access to.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I mean, we do science for many different reasons, right? It's a vast endeavor. People do science to make money and advance their, you know, their standing in the world, but also out of curiosity. You know, one of my favorite examples is Newton and Descartes freaked out about rainbows. They were just like, how in the world do rainbows exist? Right. And they literally did some of their best physics, color theory, math to understand how it is that when light bends through water molecules, it turns into rainbows. So that's curiosity and wonder that leads to a new view of the world. And I think at its best, the scientific endeavor is about awe. You know, it's about, I don't know this. I have these cool tools, sophisticated tools. I can understand a phenomenon. And just like you said, I have an aesthetic experience of seeing of what underlies the perceived world. You know, when I studied facial expression, learn how to code faces, all of a sudden I saw so much in the face I didn't know existed. When we study human vocalization and all the ways in which we convey different emotions with the voice, I was astounded suddenly to hear things differently, like music, right? And I think a lot of scientists feel that way, that, you know, the scientific method of deep observation, putting aside bias, opening your mind, and like you said, look for these big systems underlying what we perceive, it can be awe-inspiring and make you almost spiritual, you know? So I think that's a terrific question, Brandon. I hope you study it scientifically.
Right.
I know you are.
Yeah. Well, among scientists anyway.
Beauty at Work is brought to you by Templeton Religion Trust. If you enjoyed this clip, go check out the full episode. And please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a review. It really helps get the word out about the show. Thanks, and see you next time.